Today we're continuing our conversation about Hamilton, and if you look at this thumbnail image, yeah, that's my face in there dancing as Lin-Manuel Miranda, and yeah, it's not really all that great. I did it myself, and I am not a graphic artist. However, it's just sort of my daughter. I showed it to Leah, my daughter, and I said, what do you think? And she said, well, it's just kind of part of the whole cheesy thing that you're doing with your thumbnails for your jump starts. And I went, yes, exactly. It's all part of the cheesiness. So today, as we talk about tomorrow, by the way, we're going to talk about the actual process of dueling, how it came to be, and more importantly, where it went and why it went away, and also about the Hamilton and his part in the duel, etc. But today, I want to read you something from Wikipedia. This is the Federalist Papers. I told you we were going to talk about the Federalist Papers, but only as a setup towards something that is very important for each of us in our own lives. The Federalist Papers, there we go. The Federalist Papers, according to Wikipedia, is a collection of 85 articles written by Alexander Hamilton, James Madison, and John Jay under the collective pseudonym Publius to promote the ratification of the United States Constitution. Boy, I hope I said Publius right. I think I did. I have quotes from Publius Syrus in a couple of my books, and when I narrated the audiobook, I was always so concerned when that word came up. Not that I would say it like 30 or something, but that it's just not an easy word to say. Anyway, so there were actually three men who came together, and they wrote 85 articles. Now, originally, they were only going to write 25 of them, and they were written to promote the ratification of the United States Constitution. I don't know about you, but history was presented to me in school that, hey, everybody thought, wow, let's become a free nation. And everybody in the 13 colonies went, yes. And then everybody came together and said, yes, we are going to be a free colony. However, there's a wonderful song in Hamilton where Samuel Seabury sings a song about wanting to stay with England. And there were a lot of people who wanted to stay with England. So people actually had to be convinced, as they always do, to support something. While most people avoided responsibility for trying to get the Constitution passed, Hamilton took it on as a personal responsibility. Originally, and let me read you the lyrics. This is from a song in Hamilton that talks about the Federalist Papers. The plan was to write a total of 25 essays, the work divided evenly among the three men. Now, again, those three men were Alexander Hamilton, James Madison, and John Jay. In the end, they wrote 85 essays, 3.5 times more essays, trying to convince people that the U.S. Constitution was a good thing. And in the process, let's see, the work divided evenly among the three men, which I find interesting because there was going to be 25 and three men. Somebody was obviously going to write one more, at least. They wrote 85 essays, as we said, in the span of 6 months. John Jay got 6 after writing 5, so he wrote 5. James Madison wrote 29, which James Madison himself wrote more than they originally decided they were going to write together. Hamilton wrote the other 51. 51. What struck me about this was a couple of things. Number one, the amount of promotion and marketing that was necessary to get members of Congress and their constituents to support the United States Constitution. It's not perfect, never has been. That's why we have the amendments to the Constitution. However, to get it ratified in the first place, it took marketing, it took writing, it took promotion, it took stomping the ground to get people to notice and to support this. And three men came together to write them. Not 1,000 men, not 100 men, and certainly no women, but of course back then women would not have been invited to the party. And there's a wonderful song about the Schuyler sisters in Hamilton that talks about women being mentioned in the sequel to the Declaration of Independence, because it says all men are created equal. So three men were going to do this, but Hamilton ended up doing 51 One, he himself alone in 6 months wrote twice as many of what are now called the Federalist Papers than what they had intended to write, three of them together. There's a saying that I heard many years ago, and I spent some time researching it this morning. I was actually a couple of minutes late getting on, and one of the reasons I was late was I was actually looking at this saying. And the saying goes, if it is to be, it is up to me. If it is to be, it is up to me. So often we look around and we say, ain't it awful? Man, somebody should change that. Someone should do something about that. And that someone is never us. Remember that one of the main reasons, if you've read my books or you read my ebooks and you understand my concept of gripe, G-R-I-P-E, the five reasons that people complain, the R in gripe stands for remove responsibility. Most people would rather sit around and bitch about what is than do the work to do what could be. And the main reason they don't want to do it is they don't want to be attacked by other people, to be honest. They are afraid of being attacked by other people, and we're going to talk about that tomorrow. That's one of the main reasons that people do and don't do things. They don't want to be embarrassed. They don't want to stand out from the herd. When I was in ministerial school at Unity Village, they required us to take a 2-day orientation on diversity, they called it. 2-day diversity training. It was a full day. Now, normally we were in ministerial school from 8 in the morning until 12:30, and that was it. The rest of the day, we were in the process. We actually volunteered to do things, or we worked on outside things to develop particular skills we wanted to do as ministers. Or like me, we worked full-time jobs, which I still did. The diversity training took a 2-day, took two full days, and there were 30, 32 people in the class ahead of us that was going to graduate, and there was approximately the same number in my class. So you're looking at around 65 people were put into a large classroom for two full days, 9 hours a day. I think we got 20 minutes lunch for diversity training. Now, this diversity training was split under two headings. The first heading was having to do with race and treating people of color and treating people, I guess, without color like me. You know, I once heard it, you know, joked, I'm so pale that I don't tan, I stroke. So people like me and people of color treating everyone equally. We spent an entire day looking at that. As ministers, how could we make sure that we did that? So we looked at that for an entire day. The next day, now mind you, this was in 2001, so 19 years ago. There was no, 2002, there was no gay marriage back then. And so we had an entire day on sexual diversity, gay, lesbian, male, female, but predominantly gay and lesbian. Now, what I found interesting was that less than half of my class was male, and half of those were gay. And half of the women, I wouldn't say half of the women, but about a third of the women were gay. So somewhere between a fourth and a half of everyone in that room was gay or lesbian. And they spent a day with us talking about gay and lesbian diversity and treating everyone equally, etc. Now, at the end of the day, something was brought forward that just knocked me for a loop. I'm straight. My older brother was gay, but I'm straight. And someone pointed out that gays and lesbians were not even allowed to have holy unions on the grounds of our seminary. And because that was a common thing, was for people to get married and have holy unions. We had this big, beautiful rose garden. And I literally went, what? What? After two full days of diversity training, you're telling me that we don't even practice the one that we spent half the time on? I was so livid is the only word I could describe. So I have written proclamations and gotten them passed by cities before. So I went back, and that night I wrote a proclamation to be presented to the board of the seminary. saying that henceforth and going forward, we would practice what we preached. And I was able to get every single ministerial student except one, and we won't explain why, but I was able to get every ministerial student except one to sign it. And I went in and took it to the board, and I said, you're going to have to pass this. I took it to the president of the university. And he took it to the board, and sure enough, they passed it. I'm not trying to pat myself on the back, but what I'm telling you is that Alexander Hamilton took this old bromide, which has been around in print in the United States since at least 1959. We don't know who came up with it, but it could have been said by Alexander Hamilton, and that is, if it is to be, it is up to me. If it is to be, it is up to me. You, like me, are looking around and see things that are upsetting and are not right in your eyes. You can either remove responsibility by complaining about it to other people and ain't it awful and can you believe it and how dare they, instead of embracing what Thaddeus Goloss said, and I love this, there ain't nobody here but us chickens. If you want to change the direction of the flock, you need to step out in front. It's not done from the back, and it's certainly not done from the sidelines. The interesting thing was, after I got this proclamation pushed through the seminary, someone came up to me and told me that in 1979, now mind you, Unity is sort of built around diversity. If you go to the Unity Church here in Miami, it's diverse. You go to any Unity Church, it's diverse, typically. And by that diversity, I mean gay and lesbian, black and white, Latino, trans, you name it. Very, very, very diverse. And yet in 1979, Unity School, which has this big, beautiful swimming pool outside, wouldn't allow African Americans to swim in the pool in 79. And you know what happened? It was the first year that they had an African American student in the class, and the entire class said they were going to walk out en masse if this was not changed. The entire class, just like the classes had stood with me, said, if it is to be, it is up to me. So, what is it that you consider to be important? And are you sitting around and bitching about it? Or are you doing something about it? I give money every single month to a half dozen causes I think are important. Some I give a lot of money, some I give a little money. But the point is, I am actively doing something about these causes that are important to me, rather than just sitting around and griping about it and saying something should be done. Volunteering is doing something. Retweeting or reposting is just complaining. Doing something, taking action, doing anything you can from where you sit is better than sitting on the sidelines and complaining about it. I don't believe we would have adopted the United States Constitution without Alexander Hamilton and John Jay and James Madison all saying, if it is to be, it is up to me. I am personally going to convince the United States and the world that this is a good thing. So don't sit on the sidelines and complain. Take the time to do what's important. Anybody got any parting shots or comments before I say goodbye and get ready for us to go do our complaint-free meditation? Now's the time. I'd love to share them, and I'd love to hear what it is that you have to say. And it's easy. I haven't looked at what you all are saying. But to say, yeah, I want you to look in the mirror and go, what am I doing? You know, what am I personally doing to advance what I say is important? Now, you don't have to jump out, and you don't have to be the nasty screaming at everybody that they have to recycle, do yoga, become vegan, or vote Trump, or whatever it is. Just do your part. Knock doors if you're for Trump, or knock doors if you're for Biden. Do something. Let me read what you have to say. Will says, preach, Will. Love it, dude. Welcome, Sharon. Looks like Sharon's here for the first time. Everybody say hi, Sharon. Tammy Boatwright says, hi, Kathy Fant. Looks like we've got people here for the first time. Ed Wilmot, thank you for the self-empowerment message. We almost always limit ourselves instead of empowering ourselves. Yes. Tell Teddy good morning, says Will. I will do it. Great message, says Michelle Doherty. I want to leave you with a quote. This is from Margaret Mead. It's in my book, but everyone should know this quote. The problem is most people don't realize that it applies to them. Margaret Mead said, "Never doubt that a small group of dedicated individuals can change the world. Never doubt the power of a small group of individuals to change the world, for indeed that is the only way it has ever happened." It's the only way it has ever happened. A flock of birds has no leader. I wrote about this in my book, Happy This Year. Each individual bird decides the path of the flock. Where the flock do you want us to go? Well, actively flap your wings in that direction, and it'll begin to move others, just like the Federalist Papers. Michael says, that's awesome. Mike says, today I go training for being a polling place worker. Awesome, Mike. Exactly. Live it. Don't talk about it. All right, everybody, enjoy your day. We're going to go and meditate here and have a wonderful day. Get chilled and relaxed. And I will see you all tomorrow morning. Enjoy today. We're going to conclude Hamilton tomorrow. Bye-bye.
No more, no more complaining people. Their lives are changing. We're flying high, creating a complaint-free